tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? 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 Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
Because we all have to share the roads, that's why. Good morning, I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. This week we asked a question about the roads that made Seattle's brain split open and melt. What is the proper way to merge? Turns out the answer is very simple. The Washington State Department of Transportation told me and you, drive as far as you can in the open lanes, right up to the closure. Then you put your blinker on when you can't go any further, and the other guy let that driver in. And, of course, give the courtesy wave. Puget Sound drivers, you are not being selfish if you do this. That information made people, including many of us here at Week in Review, question the very nature of existence. Suddenly up is down, black is white. Gas pedal is brake pedal. Trunk releases, pop open the little gas tank door. It was a very confusing week. But don't worry, we are here to make everything okay on Week in Review. Bill Radke here with Joni Balter, host of
Civic Cocktail
on the Seattle Channel. Greg Nichols used to be the mayor around here. Rob McKenna used to be the attorney general around here. Yes or no question for all of you guys. People who drive past traffic all the way up to the merge, do you let them in, Joni?
I certainly do let them in, but this piece of information is absolutely killing me.
Uh-huh.
As you said, heads are splitting open because it's sort of, this is the last polite traffic city, like, in the world.
Ah.
What are you doing?
Is there a future of politeness for us? Rob McKenna, do you let that person in?
Absolutely, you know, because there have been times when I've forgotten to move over in time. People have let me in, and really, is it really that big of a burden to take an extra second and a half when people don't let
the
you?
The way
in,
I live my life, a second and a half is so precious.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, only in Seattle would we come up with a phrase like zipper merge. It
yes.
sounds like something out of Dan Savage's column.
More on zipper merge too. Greg Nichols, last word.
Yes, you let him in, but depending on the circumstances, the wave may have five fingers or one.
Indeed. We're right. going to settle this argument. I'll lay this out for you in a couple of minutes here. I'd love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Look for the hashtag. The phone number, you can do that too, 206-685-2526. That's 685-BLAM. KUOW's Week in Review. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke. Well, this week, a cluster of wildfires in Okanagan County became the largest in recorded Washington state history. And then things got a little better on the fire lines. Let's get an update right now from Paige Browning, news correspondent at Spokane Public Radio, joining us live. Paige, hello.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. What's the latest on the fire situation across central and eastern Washington?
Well, as you mentioned, the storms earlier this week did help firefighters, especially with stunting the fire's growth. It wetted a lot of the areas around the major Carlton complex of fires in central Washington, but it's still burning pretty big. 250,000 acres are the size of the fire now, but firefighters have it 55% contained, and because of that, there are no longer any mandatory evacuations as of today.
How are people dealing with the situation there, Paige?
Well, for a lot of people, they still haven't been able to go back to their property, which could mean their residence or their orchard or their ranch where they're raising cattle. So people are just kind of, you know, biding their time, waiting to be able to see what the damage was and then where they need to go from there. Other counties have stepped in to help from across the region. Some for firefighting efforts, and some to go and give them mental health counseling and help for people who are kind of at a loss of what to do right now.
What does the weekend forecast look like for firefighters?
Well, not good is what I've heard today. The rain that we had this week is gone. When we get to the weekend, we're expecting highs in central Washington and eastern Washington into the 90s. By Tuesday, a high near 100 for the area of the Carlton complex, and pretty low humidity. And another thing I wanted to mention is with people coping with the situation here, a big topic that they're dealing with is animals, domestic animals. There are shelters set up for people's pets, but but a lot of livestock has actually died in the fire, and people are wondering what to do with their dead cattle, dead horses, other things like that. There aren't any answers so far.
Paige Browning, news correspondent at Spokane Public Radio, with the update on the fires. Paige, thank you for that.
Thank you.
250,000 acres on the Carlton complex. Now, earlier this week, I talked to a woman who was forced out of her home in Brewster in the Meadow Valley, about 20 miles north of Chelan. Brenda Riggin is her name, and she said her home, fortunately, is standing, but
there was no notification of any kind. We didn't get any evacuation order. We didn't get a warning. Everyone was just left to fend for themselves.
No evacuation notice, she said. So on KUOW, we asked the sheriff of Okanagan County, Frank Rogers, why she got no warning. And he said, well, her house was not yet on the evacuation list. He said it's impossible to know where a fire that big is going next. And even if they did know, you can't warn everybody.
It worked. The system worked. It's worked for 30 years. It worked. It's just sometimes you're going to get caught off guard.
The system worked, but sometimes you get caught off guard. Rob McKenna, you ran for to be the governor of Washington State. Would you accept that our warning system works?
You know, we've seen a lot of problems with warning systems over the years. That, for example, different agencies don't interoperate with each other very well sometimes. So I think that, you know, the public ought to be heard here, and there should be a postmortem on the system. Let's find out if it did work or didn't work properly, and let's see if we can update the technology. You know, I've been in other cities where I've received text messages about, you know, flash flood warnings on my phone from area code 425. So let's check the technology and see if it needs to be updated.
What happens when cell phones drop it? You can't get text messages.
Well, then of course, that system doesn't work. So there are always going to be limits. If there's such a big catastrophe that the system itself goes down, then you have to drop back to another form of communication, as they did in Okanagan County.
Well, radio, by the way, still, I mean, if you really,
plug
if you,
for radio?
A plug for radio, if you live in a fire-prone right. area and it's July in Washington State and you don't have a battery-powered radio, that's, you know, somewhat on you.
Well, the city of Seattle actually has a variety of different communications methods that will be used if and when the big one comes or whatever disaster.
By the way, this is former Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels.
And the final one actually is shortwave radio. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of volunteers with a very old technology, but one that is likely to survive when many of the others don't. I think one of the issues, and Rob and I kind of dealt with this when we were colleagues on the county council, and that is, what is your expectation? If you are trying to escape the city and go to a very low-density area, you know, how much of that kind of a support system can you really expect to be there? I agree. There should be a postmortem. There are a lot of questions that are being raised here legitimately. And it seems like with the rain patterns changing that we're going to have more of these wildfires in the future. So we should be ready. But I do think we have to have people understand that if you live in such a remote area, it is not going to be a 3-minute 911 call that is going to get you help. You're going to have to rely in some way on yourself and your neighbors while that help is assembling and trying to come and rescue you.
Well, Slate had a map of the drought areas of the United States, and it told in just spectacular manner just how dry some of these areas are. I think the reason some of us were caught off guard, first of all, very fast-moving fire. Nobody expected it to be this big this early in the fire season. I went on the National Interagency Fire Center website, and you know the Northwest, so Oregon and Washington, are the epicenter of the fire season, and no one would think that in July. But as you just said, the forecast, it's going to get hot again.
You know, first of all, you mentioned rain patterns and drought. President Obama mentioned climate change as at least an exacerbating factor of the fires when he was here. Any disagreement on that?
No.
On our panel?
It probably is a factor. At the same time, you know, the biggest fire in recorded history took place 100 years ago. It was documented by Tim Egan in The Big Burn.
Yes.
So this is a phenomenon that afflicts the Northwest, and it's episodic. So I think that, you know, with the technology we have today, with real-time satellite imagery, with a plethora of communications devices, the fact that Google can look on your house, look in your house, listen to your Wi-Fi, what have you. It seems
to me.
Isn't
that the NSA?
Yeah. Well, I think Google knows more about us than the NSA. But I'm just saying that, you know, let's see if we can make sure that even rural areas have up-to-date technology so they can be notified and have redundant systems to do so.
As a Republican, do you downplay climate change any more than the mainstream, the conventional wisdom in Washington State, Rob McKenna?
Well, this Republican doesn't, but you know there are folks out there who wonder about how accurately it can be measured, and also I think it is a valid point to say not to confuse weather with climate, and it's a very, very complicated system. But certainly we're seeing less rainfall over a longer period of time in some parts of the country, and that's exacerbating the fire danger. I've been in Southern California several times in the last year and a half. They have a serious drought down there, which is affecting more than just fire danger.
Joni Balter, this week we talked with your husband, as we mentioned a moment ago, New York Times writer Tim Egan, about why people live in these fire-prone areas.
People like to live, you know, close to nature. They like to live with open views. They like to live with public land at their doorstep that has no restrictions. All these things are attractive to people. Despite all the efforts of government agencies to say you need to create a defensible space, you need to not have a roof that could catch fire, you need to clear 100 yards around your house, even the insurance industry, which is one of the drivers in this area because they won't insure people who live in fire country, has not held back the tide of people who want to live in these pretty, they're not even isolated anymore. I mean, you can get everything your urban needs are in the nearby town. So there's been this huge influx of people who live in fire country.
Does anyone here feel that we should be less than sorry for or not give government emergency aid to people who live in fire country?
Oh, no, insurance? No. We're all in this together. This is, there are some 7,000 firefighters who are assembled fighting these fires across Washington State. And, you know, I have certainly no compunction about the governor and the emergency agencies bringing in as many people as is necessary to protect life and property.
Well, most of the folks who are there are orchardists, they're farmers. Right. I mean, they live off the land. You know, they're not, it's not just this image of everybody has their second home or something like that. These are folks who live there through the good months and the bad months.
And they're engaged in economic activity, which is important for our state when you talk about food production, for example. The other point I wanted to make, though, is that this fire devastated Pateros and Brewster. These are small towns. These are not remote areas. These are small towns. You've probably been through them, whether you realized it or not, when you were driving up to Chelan. And when I saw the Instagram photos, friends of mine who lived there were posting, I was absolutely stunned at how the fire had come right down to the town. And they certainly can't be blamed for that. That was just a terrible disaster.
Yeah, I don't think there's blame. What I think is there ought to be an expectation both ways. How prepared do you need to be as an individual or as a small community? And then how much help should you expect to happen and how quickly? And we do that in the city for earthquakes. We go neighborhood to neighborhood and talk to people about how for about 72 hours our systems are going to be down and you're going to need to have food right. and water. Your neighbors, you might have to have some extra because your neighbors might have forgotten mm-hmm. and you're going to need to kind of take care of your own little enclave there until help comes.
There are many local donation centers in central Washington. The Red Cross is asking for money or gift cards. So this week, President Obama declared a federal emergency because of the fires, meaning federal aid. The president, of course, was also here to hoover up some East Side money and some Seattle money. So what is it like to be a politician who constantly has his hand out for donations? If only we had two politicians here to answer that. Rob McKenna, Greg Nichols, Joni Balter, too. Stay tuned to KUOW's Week in Review. Bill Radke, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. So this week, President Obama came to town for a fundraiser in Seattle and one in Hunts Point that cost $25,000 per person. Former Seattle Mayor Greg Nichols, what's the most amount of money you've asked a donor for?
Well, in Seattle and King County, we have fairly strict contribution limits. So generally, I believe the city is $650 or $750. double that if it's a couple. So somewhere, you know, $1,500 perhaps from a couple.
What's that like?
Well, it's a really interesting experience. it is a real test on how much you want to serve in whatever that office, that capacity is, because calling people you don't know and asking them for money is a difficult and somewhat unnatural act. Mm-hmm. And you have to want to do whatever it is at the end of that pretty badly in order to put yourself through it.
Former state attorney general, gubernatorial candidate Rob McKenna, what's the most you've asked someone for?
Well, the limit at the state level in 2012, I think, was $3,600, if memory serves. So that's the most you could ask someone to donate. Or you could ask them to ask their spouse to donate an equal amount. That would be $7,200. But, you know, races have statewide have become so expensive with both candidates raising over $10 million that, you know, it's just you make those asks again and again and again. And then with you get to the presidential level and they're holding events like the one in Medina where it might be $35,000 to attend. Every individuals can't change that. They have to deal with the system as they find it. So it really takes all of us together to decide when we want to say enough is enough.
Well, I'm just curious for both of you. Do you ask a specific amount or you just say, I'm amazing and you should give money to my campaign and whatever you feel is good?
You ask for a specific amount.
Sales technique.
If you leave it open, you're likely to get a lot of nice $50, $75 contributions. If you put an amount, the worst they can say is no, but it gives a target.
Click is how you do that on the phone. You just kind of
few people are insulted by the notion they can afford to give that much. So you're never going to hurt their feelings. They might choose to donate less.
I've never been shy about asking people for a donation of, let's say, $50 for an entire year of listening to.
You have a lot to learn about sales,
public radio. Yeah, we're small time. Republican Party, the state party, issued a statement that said, in part, instead of fundraising, the president should fly to Eastern Washington and walk on the scorched ground of Okanagan and Chelan counties. Is it inappropriate to raise money in the same state as a wildfire?
It doesn't look good. I think that the people up there probably were wondering why he couldn't make it stop by. He did stop at Oso, which I commend him for. But it is an uncomfortable juxtaposition, and it would have been for any politician, not just President Obama, to be raising huge amounts of money at a fancy event at Medina, given what was happening. So.
Well, and beyond that, what's happening in the world was where some of the national criticism came in. You're on a 3-day fundraising, and you know we're having all this trouble in Ukraine and Gaza. I mean, it was.
Did that feel wrong to you? I feel like there's always something horrible going on.
It's true, but it just never looks good for the commander-in-chief to be on the golf course or at a fundraiser. It's just a terrible juxtaposition. I understand the pressure that presidents are under to raise as much money as they can for their party, but it's been a really tough month, and so it was a particularly unfortunate comparison this month.
I think the reality is that wherever the president is where the White House is. It has full communications. He is governing. The optics, though, I agree, are not ideal.
Is the president a hypocrite for raising money for a super PAC for Senate Democrats, which he once promised not to do because he hates all the unlimited money in politics?
Well, I hate all the unlimited money in politics, too, but you have to run under whatever the rules are. Presumably, if you feel strongly about your agenda, you want to win. So you have to play the game the way the rules are set out.
I agree, and I think
the rules ought to be changed.
I agree with that. You live within the rules as you find them. You can't unilaterally disarm. At the same time, you don't have to attack the other side for doing essentially what you're doing. That doesn't sound good.
Well, he said he was trying to match some Koch brothers' money by running around the West Coast this week. That was the goal because there's so much money on the other side in the Senate races. So.
I thought I had Tom Steyer helping match the Koch brothers' money for all the Indonesian coal money that he made.
Isn't fundraising harder for liberal politicians who think that there's too much money in politics? I mean, if you think money is free speech, then fundraising is just a great conversation, isn't it?
It is free speech. I mean, you know what Slade Gorton always said is that just make it instantly disclosable and let the public see it right away and quit trying to put dams up because, water, as he puts it, is like money. Money is like water on a sidewalk. It always finds the cracks. So better to be transparent about it than to keep trying to erect new barriers, which inevitably just result in unintended consequences like 527s and even PACs themselves, which didn't exist before their fundraising reform of the early 1970s.
You know, Seattle had a system in the early 1970s, actually the late 1970s, where small contributions by Seattle residents would be matched by public money. Mm. And what it did was it reduced the size of the average contribution significantly, and it increased the number of people who are contributing and participating in the system. It seems to me that something along those lines ultimately will get people feeling like they're members of Congress or senators actually represent the state rather than whatever interests are contributing to their campaigns.
That's former Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels with former State Attorney General Rob McKenna, Democrat, Republican Joni Balter, a host of Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. And we are going to do more here on KOW's Week in Review. You know, the president landed at Boeing Field. He took I-5 into Seattle toward his fundraiser in Madrona. Do we figure he took the Madison exit? Probably Madison to Union.
It was Medina, not Madrona.
34.
Right?
Well, Madrona first.
We went to both.
Yeah.
Oh,
so we had to probably go down.
I sensibly left town during that period. So.
Then probably Lake Washington Boulevard to the Montlake entrance to 520, I guess, where the 520 toll cost him. He spent most of the money he had just raised. Then it was on to Hunts Point. All the while, his motorcade causing traffic jams. My question is, when you hit a traffic jam and you have to merge.
Oh,
see how I did
here
that?
We go.
Oh, that was good.
What?
Here we go.
And we
nice.
Hope
a turn to a zipper. Oh,
we hope
my
the
God.
President gave you a courtesy wave, by the way. But what is the right way to merge? Do you wait your turn or crowd up to the front and merge at the last moment? The controversial answer in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. Former Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels pumping his fist at that weather forecast.
73 and sunny in Seattle is perfect.
Former State Attorney General Rob McKenna and Joni Balter, Seattle writer, news analyst, and Bill Radke, too. We KUOW blew some minds this week by asking the state DOT what's the right way to merge. There was road work on I-90 that narrowed the freeway down to one lane in Bellevue, and some drivers got into that lane and they waited in line while other drivers zoomed past them, got as far as they could, and then put on their blinkers so they could cut in line, which is cheating, right? But DOT spokesperson Travis Phelps told me on the air that zooming past like that is the proper thing to do.
It actually does help the flow. Now, again, folks sometimes think of that as cheating, but that's the way we have our traffic control set up, is to gradually merge those folks over. If you're in that right lane, it's best to follow it all the way to the end and turn your blinker on, let folks know you're going to merge in, and make sure you're letting the other drivers know, hey, I want to get in here. And those drivers in the left lane can let those folks in. That's going to help people merge in a lot more efficiently, and you're going to see that backup decrease substantially.
Seattle drivers heard that conversation and lost their mind. Travis Phelps' comments went big on our website, on Twitter, on Reddit. This person spoke for many people, posting, I simply refuse to let someone get in front of me. I will throw bleeping batteries at your car.
Oh.
Does he mean car batteries or AAA batteries? I'm not sure. But the idea that you are a better driver if you cut in line like some kind of New Yorker is a bombshell, Joni Balter. Do you rush to the front of the line? And if not, will you start now because of that advice?
No, because I want you to know that the I-90 is now open. We don't have to go with this really awful advice. You know, Seattle.
Yeah, now that I-90 is open, we will never face traffic jams or merges.
Of course. But you think about how Seattle people behave at a four-way stop. It's you go. No, you go. Wait a second. It's your turn. That whole thing. You are killing that here as you go with this. There was one of the tweets that I saw in response to this story was somebody said, I'm not going to let somebody in who got a few extra seconds of sleep ahead of me, and now they want to get in front of me.
Yep.
You remember that book, Everything You Need to Know, you learn in kindergarten?
Right.
And one of the things you learn in kindergarten is to get in line and not take cuts and all
yes.
that. It turns out they don't teach you how to drive in kindergarten. and DOT actually knows what it's talking about here. It has to do with the idea of using the capacity which is available. You know, I've been in places where the line, everyone's being very polite and they're getting in that line, but it's so long, it's actually blocking traffic behind them because people can't get over through it.
Yep.
So it turns out if the capacity is there, we should be using it, and that, you know, actually capacity helps in those situations if you use it. They're like pipes. You know, you want to. It's better to have two pipes you're filling up than one long pipe that extends twice as far back.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Just as one example, I told my wife about this conversation, and she said, "That's ridiculous. He's justifying the way he drives." I said, "No, he's speaking for the state transportation department." It's like, if you don't want to believe this is true, you just won't believe it.
I think this calls for the voluntary suspension of disbelief. You know, it is logical, and it makes sense, I think, to the engineers. To you and I, who are out there and we're trying to cope with a tough situation, whether it be a daily traffic jam or the I-90 situation, it just doesn't feel right.
It absolutely doesn't.
So if we all spend a week, voluntarily suspend disbelief, try it, maybe that'll change our traffic culture. But until then, my guess is there are going to be a lot of hurt feelings.
We are stuck in the middle, right? It's because New Yorkers, they're way past this debate, right? You move forward and nobody feels bad. But it's like here's what we need. Minnesota is actually doing a public campaign along these lines. Like, I asked Travis Phelps, why aren't there signs to tell us how to merge? He said, I don't have an answer for that, or words to that effect. So what we need is leadership. If you're Governor Rob McKenna, if you're mayor again, Greg Nickel, will you start a campaign to convince Seattle to switch, to change our culture and merge, zipper merge?
Yeah, motto.
Will you sign my zipper merge pledge?
I'm going to get you on light rail. That's what I'm going to do.
The slogan is, I'm cutting in front of you, but it's for your own good.
That works. Okay, KOW's Week in Review. Then there's the question, I'm going to leave you with this. Ladies and gentlemen, I present, and I think all of us feel, have this person inside us. I present the sanctimonious Seattle driver.
When it comes to merging, I merge very early. I try and get in line along with the other good people. And then I straddle the line so that people can't break up the side and cause us all
perfect.
Wait longer than is necessary. I'm kind of like the traffic police, and I'm not doing it to be annoying.
No one would find that annoying. Don't worry.
His
not
last word was, not I'm doing it so everyone gets there at the same time. Really? Listen, if you want to give your two cents, this issue's not done. I want to know, will you make the switch? You know, because I'm serious. To me, this is an opportunity because we're in this middle zone where now that I'm convinced, I will be one of those. I'm changing and I'm going to move ahead. And which in New York, everyone is, right? But right now, I'm going to save tons. I'm going to sleep in Seattle. I'm going to love it.
I think it has to do with the wave that was also advised so that you can still maintain your Seattle courtesy. Mm. That is not, and not the way the former mayor recommended that you wave. That with a full hand. What's a full hand? So that you at least show you're still courteous, but you're trying to adjust to this new crazy way of merging.
Let us know what you think and what you are going to do about it. Our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. We're on Twitter. Look for the hashtag. It's KUOWWIR. It's for Week in Review. You'll find us on Twitter. You know how. 206-685-2526 is our phone number, which coincidentally is 685-A-JAM. KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke with Joni Balter of Seattle Channel, Civic Cocktail, and we are pleased to have former Seattle Mayor Greg Nickels, former State Attorney General Rob McKenna with us. The first 10 days of marijuana sales earned the state more than $318,000 in excise taxes. We found that out this week. That doesn't count sales tax or B&O tax revenues. Rob McKenna, you were, as we said, State Attorney General, ran for governor as a Republican. You opposed legal marijuana. Were you wrong?
No, because it's still illegal federally. My opposition was based in the idea that it's really problematic in a society based on the rule of law for something to be legal under one jurisdiction's laws and illegal under the national laws. And I still am troubled by that. I was troubled by Attorney General Holder announcing that, well, you know, you just don't enforce the laws you don't happen to agree with. And so they just unilaterally decided, well, we won't enforce federal law here. Now, look, it's perfectly reasonable for us to change our laws. We did so when we enacted prohibition, and then we repealed prohibition. But I continue to be troubled by the notion that, you know, people are breaking federal laws every day and the federal government's just saying, well, we'll turn the other, you know, we'll look the other way, even though presumably they're still enforcing those laws in states that haven't yet legalized at the state level.
And more states are coming because Oregon has decided to put pot legalization on the ballot, and many other states are going to do this. This sort of feels to me a little bit like the gay marriage fight that we've had, and when it's just public opinion just starts changing and you can feel the change.
So yeah, isn't this how that happens, Rob McKenna, that state by state? I mean, the states individually are working on that problem.
Yeah, but I mean, can you think of another instance where the states just decided to ignore federal law? I mean, when prohibition was repealed, it was repealed nationally. On the other hand, when the speed limit went into effect, it was adopted everywhere, and it wasn't changed till federal policy changed, even though it wasn't technically a federal law, but they had a way of encouraging the states to adopt it. So I just really have trouble if we're moving in a direction where law enforcement and the judicial system is just saying, well, we'll just enforce the law selectively depending on local conditions. I think that's just really troubling. And it's not so much the issue of pot itself. You know, I mean, because we're adults. We can change our minds about such things. It's the idea that we're going to have two different systems of laws and the feds get to choose which ones they want to enforce.
It seems to me that this is a tradition that America has had, where states and the federal government have jousted on issues, and we resolve it over time as public opinion moves one way or the other. And Washington and Colorado are leading the way on this one, and I think it's great. I think we ought to, you know, make sure that we're sharing what works and what doesn't work with states that are considering doing the same thing. But I think it's actually a great American tradition that we're upholding here.
Well, I wrote a piece on pot for Bloomberg View last winter, and one of my points was that the big deal about it was that it wouldn't be that big a deal. And if you think about some of the many things that have been said about what's going to happen when marijuana is legal, for example, your lead in here, we thought this was going to be a huge revenue booster. The projections on that are all over the map, and they're all less than what they said during the campaign. So it's just rolling out slowly. It's very controlled. It's no big deal.
You know, I was talking to the Attorney General of Colorado this week at a conference, and he had some very interesting observations based on the early data there. For example, he said that revenues to the state are not nearly as high as forecast because people are holding on to their medical marijuana licenses because they can get their pot without paying the tax on it. And that's sort of an early indicator that a certain amount of this is going to go underground because when taxes are high, what do people do? They seek to avoid them. We've seen that with tobacco for a long time. They're also seeing some early data on consumption levels and the percentage of people who use every single day or multiple times a day. And those percentages are coming in higher than they had forecast as well.
How far do you think this will spread? If Colorado likes it, why not New Mexico next door? And do you think Nevada doesn't want you to smoke weed and gamble? Ka-ching! what's your prediction? How far does this spread, Greg Nichols?
I think this will spread fairly rapidly to a large number of states. I wouldn't say every state. I think there are some parts of the country that will maybe never or maybe a long time from now make the same decision. But I think we'll see it move pretty quickly.
There will be bumps along the road, of course, as we've seen with edibles is going to be an area that needs a lot of attention. We've talked about that. And, you know, when they've planned the Washington pot experiment, they didn't even expect the legal recreational marijuana to be a big part of the industry for like a year or even going out several years. It was expected like in a year from now to be like 25% of the total market. So it rolls out slowly. Mm-hmm.
The head of Seattle City Light had to answer for a bad couple of weeks. We'll hear about that next on KUOW's Week in Review. Good morning, I'm Bill Radke. This week, Seattle City Council members grilled City Light CEO Jorge Carrasco about the decision to hire a company to bury negative online search results about the utility and Carrasco. A Seattle Times investigation found that City Light hired an online reputation management firm to flood the web with positive stories and push negative stories further down in search results. City Council member Bruce Harrell asked Carrasco why his name was included in the more than $17,000 PR effort, and this is what Carrasco said.
The objective...
By the way, typically we would edit that soundbite just to the beginning of his sentence, but for some reason we included all 12 instances of the word.
The objective, the directive, was to improve the content and the current nature of the content of information regarding the utility and the programs that we're delivering today. And it just so happened that because my name is associated with many of those programs, they felt...
They is
the Brand.com organization told our staff, you need to include his name as well.
Man, who hired this guy?
Well, I did.
Good timing.
Oh, wait, Bill, you actually knew that, didn't you?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
So he's had a bad run here. It's more than a couple weeks now. It's the last several weeks. Mm-hmm. But if you go back, he's been superintendent now probably close to 10 years.
Yep.
I think has done a good job. And I certainly felt that way during my time as mayor. Or I would not have kept him and reappointed him. So I think there are a couple of issues here. The brand.com thing, and I think, is a judgment issue. And honestly, I don't know any more than I've read in the paper about that. The one that disturbs me is lying about whether he had asked for a raise. I think that there's a standard where we expect our public officials, whether they're elected or appointed, to tell us the truth. And if it's an uncomfortable truth, so be it. You just need to tell the truth. He did come out and apologize and correct the record, but I think that I find that disturbing.
It's always the mop-up and is worse than the event that you're talking about. And so it was his response to all the trouble that he was in when he was – I believe it was on Cairo when he said, you know, I didn't ask for this raise. We've just been talking about it like it came out of the air. But he had been asking for it. And so it was part of the cleanup instead of the actual original event.
That is a very natural thing to say. I'm not saying he should have said it. But we are used to keeping our asking for a raise –
negotiating a salary in public is an awkward thing. That's true.
Yeah.
But still, that transparency and being able to take what a public official says at face value, I think that's an important part of the compact.
If you were mayor of another city and Jorge Carrasco applied to leave Seattle and run your utility, would you hire him?
Well, I did, actually.
Yes. After what he's been through.
He was with Austin Power and Light, which is about the same size as Seattle City Light.
Well, I know you liked him then, but do you like him now?
I do like him now. Okay. It does disturb me that his first reaction to that question was a lie.
Would you have decided not to give Carrasco a pay raise after all, which Mayor Ed Murray did?
It would depend. I did give him a raise at some point during his tenure in my administration because I looked at what his peers were making. I didn't want to go through a new search for someone when I had someone who was doing the job well. And so I looked at the market and what was fair and gave him about half of what I thought was fair as an increase. So it would depend. I would not have stopped it for political expediency, but if the market didn't support it, I wouldn't have approved it.
Any final words on Jorge Carrasco?
Well, I found myself agreeing with Council Member Shauna Sawant on one point. On this, as she was speaking with him, she said very few customers Google your name to see how their service is. They either know they like your service. Now I'm extrapolating. They either know that they like your service or they don't. But it's not like a Google event.
Did you say you worked at Austin Power?
Yes.
Hey.
Yes. Groovy, baby.
Oh, international utility of mystery.
Yes.
All right. They've never heard that one before. Let's lighten up and take a walk in the park. In a moment, shall we?
Oh, okay. Indeed.
A walk in the parks. I'm sure there'll be no controversy there on KUOW's Week in Review in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Greg Nickels, used to be the mayor of Seattle. Rob McKenna, used to be the attorney general. I know you say you keep calling people mayor after they've left. You're still Mayor Nickels, right?
Many people call me many things, Bill.
You are what? Attorney General? Do people say Attorney General?
Yeah, they'll say Attorney General McKenna or former Attorney General McKenna. But there's this odd thing that's developed nationally. You don't hear it so much around here, where they just shorten it to General. So you go to AG conferences, it's General Cooper and General McKenna. And I find it very disorienting because I grew up in the military. I know what a real general is. And I
Tony Balter is saluting
you. Exactly.
I am saluting you as I always
do. Here's the way you understand the difference. When you're Attorney General, it's just an adjective. But if you're in the military, it's a noun. And that's the key difference.
Very good.
Got it. So the August 5th ballot measure in Seattle would create a Seattle Park District. Yes, you're going to be, if you're in Seattle, you will have to vote on August 5th when it's 83 degrees or whatever it is. Mayor Ed Murray hosted a news conference on Monday in support of this, and apparently it was contentious, right? With some city leaders supposedly said, if you don't like this measure, you're anti-parks.
Or your Tea Party. Did you catch that one?
Yes.
So that shows directly how impossible it is in this city to have a rational discussion about park funding.
Joni, can you rationally just sum this up very briefly to what's going to be voted on?
Yeah, what is the Tea Party view, Joni? Please.
Excellent. Thank you.
What's the Seattle
Thank you, General, I think is what I wanted to say.
What's the Park District?
The Park District is just another way of funding parks. So they have, over the years, been funded by the general fund. They are a core function of government, but they are also, there have been these six-year levies to get to some additional needs. And there's no maybe around here. Everybody loves parks. We are park smitten, you might say. But this is actually a very vigorous and interesting, to me, discussion about what is the best way to fund them. I had my ballot out, and I really stopped on the park measure, Prop 1. I was like, what? You know, first of all, I don't buy the idea that they'll never come back. They'll come back if this goes down. But this being Seattle and there being dispute, I think the default position is going to be everybody around here is for parks, increasing density, all that good stuff.
Greg Nickels, help me understand, which government program should have to ask for money every time they want money, and which should raise their own money in a special district like this? I don't know what to think.
Well, our core government functions ought to be funded in the general fund, and they ought to be supported annually on a fairly predictable level. The problem has been, I guess, a couple-fold. One, we are the fastest-growing large city in America, and I'm all for that. I increase densities as mayor and believe very strongly in dense urban areas. But that requires a support system. It requires great public transit. It requires great parks and libraries. And for the last several years, 15 or 20 years, we've had levies every 6 or 7 years for parks. And because you go and you need to make the case for this, they generally have had new parks and new community centers in them as opposed to maintenance and upkeep and improvements to our existing stock of parks, if you will. And as a result of that, the maintenance of the parks is not as good as it used to be. So I think that this step, after the voters have spoken 3 or 4 times on levies and said, yes, we want to fund parks, is a reasonable step. People argue that it's not accountable, but it's the city council that will be making the budget decisions and the mayor who will be responsible for the administration of that. So it is as accountable as our other parts of government and the other parts of the Parks Department. So I think it's a reasonable proposal, and given the rate at which we're growing, I think it's an important thing for us to do.
What's wrong with being accountable to the voters? What's wrong with saying the Muni League said this, the League of Women Voters said that?
Accountability,
make the case.
Yeah, accountability is great, but this district is not less accountable because it's a separate district. It, in fact, is overseen by the mayor and the council, and every 2 years we get to vote on half the council, and every 4 years we get to vote on the mayor. So we get to let them know whether they've done a good job or not.
Rob McKenna, you're a state guy. Do you care?
Yeah. Well, if I were on the Seattle City Council, I'd be really out of place. Hmm. But secondly,
self-awareness is important.
That's good. That's hats off to my friends, the conservatives on the Seattle City Council now,
yeah.
who apparently are conservative by some standards. But my point is, I would be worried about, in the long run, I'd be very worried that the new money would end up supplanting existing money, and you would end up no farther ahead than you were before.
There is a protection. There is a requirement in the legislation that says that the general fund support will not drop and, in fact, will be increased with inflation. Okay. So that I had that same concern.
Speaking of parks, we may have the opportunity in Seattle to create the most spectacular promenade park view in the country, the world.
Right at sea level.
Trouble is, no. There's a little higher than that, Mr. Nichols. Trouble is, this would block the view of people not in the park, and it might collapse. More in a moment on KUOW's Week in Review. I'll bet it. The view is lovely from the viaduct right now. I'm Bill Radke, and as if this hour has not been interesting enough with Rob McKenna and Greg Nichols and Joni Balter, Luke Burbank from Port Townsend, what's on your mind, sir?
I'm actually in San Francisco, California right now, so apologies if you hear me huffing and puffing. I'm walking up a hill right
sure.
now, going up Knob Hill, and I need climbing gear to get up this hill and maybe oxygen top. This is no joke. I heard you talking about the potential High Line in Seattle. Who's pushing that idea?
Well, have you been? I know you used to live in New York, Luke. Have you been on the High Line?
Absolutely.
It's, yeah.
It's lovely.
I was there last week. It's on the Lower West Side, walking it. This, if you don't know, it's an old train trestle, a mile long. It used to be this rusting relic, and they planted wildflowers and grasses, which I found out this week is kind of a reference to the overgrownness. So it's pretty, but it's wild. It's really, really nice. There's a window they put up where you watch the traffic below that was surprisingly compelling for our children. You walk past people's apartments. They made little plazas. We bought mango chili pepper popsicles that my kid hated. This, Luke, you asked about who's pushing it. Seattle Times columnist Danny Westneat has also walked that park, and he wrote, I guess a few months ago, that we ought to do the same thing with the viaduct. And this week he wrote a follow-up about how Seattle's titan of development, Martin, is it Selig or Selig?
Selig
agrees with them. So that's where this is coming from this week, Luke.
I think, if they shaved the top level off of the viaduct, that's got to make it weigh a little less, right? So that's maybe less danger there. And then if that thing were to come down in an earthquake and you were walking on it, what a way to go. I mean, it'd be a great last image in your mind frame, right?
Yes, there's that.
Perfect.
Greg Nichols, you were a big supporter of the tunnel. So what about a tunnel and a viaduct park?
Well, the High Line is wonderful, and I have spent time on it, and I've talked to the people who helped to make it happen about how they did that. The viaduct is not the High Line, in that the High Line goes basically between buildings for most of its length and connects, in many cases, those buildings. Hmm. And our viaduct doesn't do that. Our viaduct is a wall between downtown and the waterfront. And the waterfront ought to be our premier physical asset and access to it. So actually, a decade ago, I participated in something called the Mayor's Institute for City Design, where a half dozen mayors come together and make a case study of something in their city and then get advice from the other mayors and from the preeminent design professionals from around the country. And the opportunity that we have in Seattle when that viaduct comes down to create not only great public space, but great connections. Our downtown is at some points a couple hundred feet above the water. And to create connections at those street ends, not new streets necessarily, but walkways and stairways, something like on University Avenue already or University Way, that opportunity is unique. Nobody has a waterfront like that. And each of those provides a great view and a great promenade and a great opportunity for the public to enjoy views and the waterfront and a connected city.
This is a state highway, Governor McKenna. What do you have to say?
How's that sound?
It state highway sounds terrible. The main problem, of course, is just the long-term, pardon the pun, viability of the viaduct, right? It's just what convinced me that we needed to go with a tunnel is that even a new viaduct with state-of-the-art engineering would probably collapse in a major earthquake over the Seattle Fault in a liquefaction zone. Just not a good idea. So,
but like Luke said, what a way to go.
Yeah, well, it'd be the ultimate ride. You would ride it down to the ground. But I think for that reason, and because I agree with Greg, we want to open up those views. It just makes more sense to remove the structure.
Joni?
Well, that is a spectacular view because I've run the Seafair 5K or 10K or what it is.
And when rock you and roll runs that route, too.
And when you come around and you come up that viaduct, you are like, oh, my gosh, you cannot believe what you're looking at. But that said, I would be very worried about the whole – one of the big arguments for the tunnel and bringing the viaduct down was this earthquake thing. And we began the show talking about, you know, the choices people make to live in danger zones. Hmm. And we all live in a danger zone here. If you think about it, the Seattle Fault and some other faults, got to be careful.
Right.
Luke Burbank, before we go, anything else going on with you, brother?
Yeah. Well, I was listening to the earlier part of the show, the much controversial how to merge in traffic conversation. And I don't know if the zipper is better or if waiting your turn is the best way to go. But I would just offer this. This is what my therapist says to me. Let me offer something to you, the listeners out there.
I invite you to consider this.
Can I observe something to you here?
Yes.
If you want to check your emotional dipstick, ask yourself how often you're losing your S while you're sitting behind the wheel. Because even if somebody else is in the wrong, if you are spending a good part of your day screaming at other people and being really worked up about it, that is not good for you. So whatever sort of breathing techniques, whatever people have to do to not feel all the pain that we feel getting mad at other people, I would encourage people to do it however they're merging.
Yeah, Bill, thank you for ripping that scab open.
Yes, anytime. Listen, before we go, just real quick, because the Mariners are starting to lose again, but Dustin Ackley achieved not just a home run robbing catch over the wall, but it was something more this week.
Another look as he comes up over the fence. Oh, man. What a catch!
This was the platonic ideal of a catch. Plato believed that there are the imperfect instances of catches where the glove is sort of over the wall, and then there's the ideal universal form of a catch, the platonic form, which is the highest and most elemental reality and the only true source of knowledge. And in this case, it was the knowledge that Travis Arnot was out and the Mariners won 5-2.
That'll be on a lot of highlights tonight.
Wow! Wow! KOW's Week in Review, Joni Balter from Seattle Channel, host of Civic Cocktail, General McKenna, former Attorney General Rob McKenna. Are you going to run for governor again?
Not in the foreseeable future, no, probably never, but you never know.
Enticing. Greg Nichols, will you run for Seattle mayor again?
I will never run for governor of Washington.
Luke Burbank, will you be my friend?
Always, Bill. And what no one's talking about is the fact that Ackley caught that ball with his beard.
KOW is Week in Review. Those are the top stories this week. Do join us again next Friday, 10 o'clock. Thanks, everybody.